And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Linda Lloyd, and it's my pleasure to welcome Lisa Wingate, the author of Before We Were Yours, published by Ballantine Books. The book was inspired by the true story of Georgia Tan and her Tennessee Children's Home Society that operated in Memphis in the 1930s through the 1950s. Weaving the past with the present, Lisa contrasts the Stafford family, who are rich and powerful, with the Foss family, who are described as river rats. Both families become pawns in a system selling children to the highest bidder. Lisa, Before We Were Yours is based on a true story. How did you find out about Georgia Tan and her Tennessee Children's Home Society?
Well, for every story for me, there's something that I just usually stumble across in life that inspires it. This story, I was actually up late working on research and editing for another story, and I had the TV playing just kind of for company, but had the sound turned off. And I looked up, and Discovery Channel's Dangerous Women, Deadly Women, had cycled through about 2 in the morning. And I looked up, and there was this scene of this big white house with tall white columns, and in the front room there were all these baby bassinets and a nurse or two walking through, and the bassinets, you know, there were babies who were cooing and talking, and there were babies who were sleeping, and there were babies who looked red-faced and sweaty and sickly, and I thought, what is this? And part of me was saying, don't turn on the sound, you're supposed to be working. But I couldn't resist, and then I turned it on, and then there was a scene where a woman wheeled a baby pram out in the sun and left a baby just sitting in the sun and walked away and left this baby, you know, and the parent in me just recoiled, and I sat there and I just watched open-mouthed this documentary piece about Georgia Tan and the Tennessee Children's Home Society and how all of these children had been taken from their parents, often unlawfully, by her and sold into adoptions for profit. And I just kind of couldn't believe that this could happen. And so I went and I started researching it.
And you set the story based on a family that you felt like could fall into this, both ends of the spectrum, both the people who were buying the children and the people who lost their children. And the Foss family, all they had was their children because they were on the river. How did you come up with those characters?
Well, when you're developing a story, what you're always thinking about is who would tell this story? What point of view would you tell this story from? Through what set of eyes would you look at it? And at first I thought maybe I'll tell it through a social worker who encounters this, a young social worker who tries to stop this practice that's happening, or maybe a doctor. You know, I had read there were doctors who had protested things like Georgia Tan taking babies out of the hospital when they were premature and against doctors' advice. And so I was really thinking, who would tell this story? And the more I read and studied, the more I really became interested in the accounts of people who had experienced this as children, who had been through this system as children and what they went through. And I realized that their stories really hadn't been told. The way we haven't seen this documented so much is through the eyes of these little people who were completely helpless in this situation. And so I really wanted to tell the story from that point of view. And a lot of rural children were taken off the sides of dirt roads and things as they walked home from school or off front porches or that sort of thing. And so originally I thought maybe I would tell that. And then I ran across a picture of a shantyboat family and read about how they used to camp near Mud Island, was one of the riverboat camps or shantyboat camps. And I thought, what a fascinating and completely opposite life to have been a child growing up on the river in this sort of free-floating life, the shantyboat people. During the Depression, there were about 50,000 people living on shantyboats on the Ohio and the Mississippi rivers. And, you know, they had this free-floating gypsy life where they would stop in a town and work for a while and maybe put the kids in school, and then they'd float on and go to another town, and they'd float all the way south and spend the winters in the south where it was warm. And then when the seasons changed, they would get a towboat to take them back up water all the way up north, and they would do the journey again. And I just thought that was a fascinating setting and so different. You know, what would these kids experience who really haven't even experienced normal society very much? And then all of a sudden they're cast into these orphan houses and and into Georgia Tan's system.
And unfortunately, four of the children fit the profile because she actually preyed on blonde, blue-eyed children. And it's only because her mother went to the hospital and the children were left alone. How do you think she worked that system to find out about these children being left alone? And then how did that happen?
That was actually one of my fascinations after I watched the original segment. I thought, how was this possible? How would you find enough people to be complicit in this that it could happen? And it's really a function of a few things. One thing was that Memphis was very, very corrupt at the time under Boss Crump. Boss Crump had control of everything in the city, police, all the city government, all the city social work, and also was very tied into state legislature. So if there were any problems with the law, Georgia Tan really, because she was in with Boss Crump, she had the ability to get the legal regulations changed. She literally operated unregulated. She had the ability to get the assistance of sheriff's deputies to go pick kids up and bring them into the system. She had an advocate in the family court system who would help her do the legal work to take these kids legally. And they were taking them from people who had really no ability to fight, people who had no resources, people who maybe showed up at a family aid clinic looking for free milk for their kids. Because a lot of this time period was during the Depression, and people were incredibly poor. So they might show up for medical care, they might show up for food, or they might show up at a hospital to have a baby or with a sick child. Young mothers were very often told, this baby is sick, this baby needs medical care, and a social worker would say, will you give the baby to me, and I will take the baby and get the medical care for this baby or get a checkup for this baby. And then they would just go back a few days later and tell the young woman the baby was dead. The baby had died. It also happened mothers who would go in to have babies, single mothers especially, were easy prey. They would just tell them the baby hadn't survived the birth, and they would take the baby into the system, and that would be, you know, the last the mother ever heard of that baby, thinking the baby had passed away. But they had spotters everywhere. They had spotters in orphanages, they had spotters in social work, they had spotters in hospitals. So they were watching. She had a network of people who were watching for these kids. Part of why that's so hard to imagine today, and part of why it was able to happen then, you have to understand a little bit about what adoption was like previous to the era of Georgia Tan. Not too many years before that, adoption really didn't happen. People would sometimes take kids in as farm laborers, whatnot. My father-in-law's family, there were a number of boys who grew up and were known as Uncle Hal and Uncle so-and-so, but they really weren't uncles. They were boys that his father had taken in and raised on the farm, and, you know, by all accounts, they remained close to the family. It wasn't a bad situation, but people didn't take kids in as sons and daughters very often. It just wasn't really done. And really, in that era, you know, gangs of kids roamed the streets, and like you see in third world countries. And if a woman had a child she wanted to get rid of that she didn't want to raise or couldn't raise, in that era, if she couldn't get one of the few orphanages to take the child, she literally went to what was called a baby farm, and she paid a baby farmer $50 to take over care of the child, like you would at the dog pound or something. And of course, there really wasn't any motivation on the part of these baby farmers to then care for these children. So that's the system into which Georgia Tan comes, and orphans were viewed as somehow damaged, not worthy of
being... Because nobody wanted them.
Right, exactly. And so that's the system into which she comes, and that's the reason why she was able to create what she created and get away with the kinds of crimes, basically, that she got away with.
The Foss family was so happy, even though they had nothing. And here's this person who comes in and basically takes everything that they've ever had. Why was it so important that she changed those children's name as soon as she got them?
She did that very often. And that was one of the reasons it was very hard for people to go back and find their birth families or their heritage. I mean, partly because of the records, because of the fact that the records were sealed right after Georgia Tan's reign, basically, but also because she changed records. She would make kids younger by a year or two. She would change their names. She would change their heritages. New York was a big outlet where she would send kids predominantly to Jewish families who wanted to adopt Jewish children. And so they thought they were adopting children of Jewish heritage. And in reality, they were adopting Tennessee dirt farm kids from the country around Shelby County. And she would say that kids had musical talent in their family or artistic talent in their family, if that's what the prospective parents requested. And so it also set up a lot of situations for disappointment on the part of adoptive parents who maybe got a kid who was average intelligence or below average intelligence or didn't have musical talent or whatever the situation was. But she basically was in the made-to-order business, and she did what she could to make the children to order and to make sure their birth families would not find them.
Well, in the beginning, you referred to a Saturday Evening Post article. Was that to get people interested in adopting children?
I actually have an original copy of that article from 1930. So you're right at the end of the baby farm era and into the beginning of this modern theory of adoption, which they call Georgia Tan the mother of modern adoption, because she really fostered this idea and she really cultivated wealthy clients so that people would think, well, this is an okay thing to do, to adopt children. So I think really that the article is intended to laud this process of adopting a child as your own and how wonderful that can be and how they are little blank slates who you then can write on and make them anything you want. Georgia Tan used to tell people that they're blank slates. They can become anything you want them to be. But the tone of the article by today's standards just gives you chills. There's a part in that article that says something to the effect of, she's talking about, and she doesn't name Georgia Tan by name, but if you know the history of Georgia Tan, you know that's who she's interviewing about modern adoption. And she's talking about the people who come into this agency in a day, and she says, maybe a professor and his wife come through and they select this kind of child, and maybe next a city worker and his wife come through and they select this kind of child, and maybe next a bachelor. Bachelors want children too. It just gives you chills by today's standards. You think, how could this have ever been written up in this nice sounding article in the Saturday Evening Post? But it was.
And the only reason that Rill is able to maintain her sanity at this time, because she's losing her siblings and she's the oldest, is she keeps saying, she can't control my mind. She can't control where I go in my mind. Do you think that she was older for her years because of her life on the river or what she had seen?
I think she has a very strong sense of herself. That's one of the things in the interviews I did with people who had grown up in county homes and orphanages and places. And those experiences varied. I talked to people who had wonderful experiences growing up in group homes and enjoyed having all the other kids around and were well cared for by loving, wonderful people. And I talked to people who had horrible experiences. And at one point, I was interviewing a woman who heads up the kitchen in a free lunch cafe now and has had a long career, but this is what she does in her retirement years. And she grew up in a county home with her brothers and sisters, and she was the youngest one. The father dropped them there after the mother died. And it was a horrible experience for her. When the other kids would go away to school, she was the one left in this home, and she was molested by the man who ran the home. And she said, when I got a little older, I just decided that wasn't going to define me. I was going to define who I was, and I wasn't going to let what somebody else had done for me or decided for me to define who I am. And that, to me, she was the inspiration for Rill's determination to basically define herself, you know, to hold to her sense of identity as who she is and to try to reunite with her siblings and keep them together. And that's really her driving force, I think, is that she's not going to let what's happened to her ruin her and define her. And that's really, in the story, that was the thing I admired about her most is that she knows who she is and she's so determined to remain who she is.
And even years later, when she starts to reconnect with her siblings, she knows that it's better not to sometimes reveal that.
It was a difficult situation for people who had come out of this system because they had completely different lives by then. And society being what it is in the South, there's a big difference between you as a child of an upscale family who's well-respected and you as a child of dirt farmers or river gypsies or whatever. And by the time a lot of these people found out who they were or reconnected, they had lives going on. They had children. They had all kinds of people in their lives who had no idea. Maybe they even had no idea where they'd come from. The younger Foss siblings probably wouldn't have even known who they were, had been. And so, you know, it's a tough decision people have to make. And I wrestled with that in the book. Why do they make the decision they make? But so many people are affected. I think that's one thing I've realized doing interviews and talking to people now that the book is getting ready to come out. I talked to a woman in her 30s the other day, and her father was adopted. And she said, you know, I just want to know where we go from there, where our medical history is, who we are from before my father. And she'll probably never find out because it was one of those situations that used to happen in the Depression era where literally her great-grandmother found them wandering. And they just kept the kids. The woman who had them didn't want them, and they just kept them. There's not any legal anything for her to trace down. But I hadn't really thought about how much it affects the future generations.
But this story really illustrates that, you know, as Avery starts to uncover things, and Avery is one of the other characters in the book that meets Rill, who becomes May, which gets kind of confusing, I understand, but it makes a lot more sense when you read it all.
Right.
And as she starts to delve into this, you know, she finds out that there are a lot of people out there that this happened to. Does this still happen?
I don't know that it still happens in this. I mean, things are certainly much more regulated. And that was one of the good things that did come out of this scandal finally being revealed, is a lot of new legislation and things to regulate adoption and what could be charged and how, whether kids could be taken across state lines or not, and adoptions and all that kind of thing. Certainly we know of situations where it happens with kids coming from other countries and that kind of thing. And, you know, we need to be aware of it, definitely. And that's one of the things I hope comes out of this book, is an awareness of what it's like for these kids. There are certainly still kids today here and all around the world, but in our country too, who have to lay their heads down at night wondering, you know, am I safe? How long will I be here? How will these people in this place treat me? Will they be nice to me? Will they be mean to me? Do they care about me at all? You know, there's certainly kids sharing all those feelings that Rill has. And even as adults, you know, they don't have the ties maybe that other people have who grew up in a birth family. And so I think a lot of Rill's situation does still happen today. And the more we can live it in a story, the more then when we look out in our own lives and we see people who may be in those situations, we understand what those emotions are like.
Well, I just thought that May had such a wonderful aspect on life. She had actually become very successful in her own right because of her adoptive father, and discovered music. And she talks about the music and how each scene has a different song for it.
She's made the most of her life. She did have musical talent, which she actually got from her father on the riverboat because he used to play on the show barges and things. So she has this talent, and she did fall into a musical family, which gave her tremendous opportunity because her adopted father is involved in writing scores for Hollywood movies in the big era of Hollywood. And so she naturally falls into that. And so she's had this really great life. And she does muse on the fact of, would I trade this life for the life I would have had if I hadn't been taken off that shanty boat? Would I rather have been a riverman's wife or a fisherman's wife or some such thing? And she really can't say that she would have traded the life she got. And that's true in reality. I mean, a lot of these kids did have really good lives. They did go into loving, wonderful homes where they had tremendous opportunities. And there were certainly kids who were taken by the Tennessee Children's Home Society out of terrible homes, out of terrible situations, and they were put in good homes. I read just not too long ago a book written in 1950 called For the Love of Martha. It's the other side of the story. it's written by an adoptive mother who disguised the circumstances some because she didn't want to be found, about this little vermin-infested, wart-covered 3-year-old girl that was brought to them after they applied at the Tennessee Children's Home Society. And, you know, this child was so damaged from the birth family. She'd come up in just sort of wandering the streets in this family where the parents were both alcoholics and drug addicts, and there were several siblings just sort of fending for themselves, and this was the youngest one. And so these wonderful people who had great intentions to adopt and who'd been waiting for years through social services and couldn't get a baby, and they found out about the Tennessee Children's Home Society, and very quickly they're brought this 3-year-old, and they go into this hotel room to pick this child up. It's laying on the bed covered by a bath mat, and the social worker pulls the bath mat back, and they're just horrified. They see this stunted, skinny, vermin-infested child, and they take the child home, and the child has all kinds of emotional problems and fits and screaming problems and night and day, and they go through weeks and months of basically loving this child back to life. And then they're at the very end of the Tennessee Children's Home Society, right when it was revealed. And so then they go through years of panic of trying to legalize this adoption and keep this child from being sent back to what was a very bad home situation. And so that's the other side of the coin. There were people who did get children and put them in very good situations and then were left very vulnerable before and after the Georgia Tan scandal, because Georgia also would blackmail people once she had given them children. She would come and threaten to take the children away and would want more money and things. And so the other side of the coin is what some of these families went through who got kids and who didn't realize what they were getting into. And once they did, they were there. The beautiful little ending to that story about For the Love of Martha is I had looked that book up on Amazon, and there was a review, and it said, I found this book in my dad's house, and I asked him, why did we have such an old book on the bookshelf? And he said, my great-grandmother wrote it about my grandfather.
Oh, wow.
So Martha was actually a boy, and this was the granddaughter finding the legacy.
And so she's able to go back and say, look, this is the opposite side. This is what can happen. And this is who I am. This is who I came from.
Right.
And I did like that about Avery and her family because, you know, they're part of this. But her story is completely different. And Avery is in her own path of discovery. She's trying to do what she's been brought up to do. Talk a little bit about the Staffords and how you ended up in Aiken, South Carolina from Tennessee.
I was thinking who would tell the other half of the story. And of course, you think of how difficult it would be to be a very prominent, very visible family in politics in the South and find out you have maybe skeletons in your closet. And Avery's really, her first worry is just that maybe her family was complicit in this because they're a longtime political family. She's the daughter of a senator, and they go way back in politics. The Staffords are well-known in the South in politics. And her fear is that perhaps her relatives, her grandfather, people may have been complicit in changing the laws and allowing this to happen. It's not that she has any real suspicion that this plays into her family directly, into her bloodline or anything, but she's worried, what role did we have in this? How are we connected to this when she starts to find out about it? But it begins to change her sense of who she is. You know, what she learns from May, the journey of Rill, who becomes May, is that you have to define yourself. You cannot be defined by other people. You can, but you can't live authentically that way. Every story really is about a character who begins in some situation that's not mentally, emotionally, physically authentic to who that person is. The journey in the story is really about learning to live out loud, you know, learning to come out from behind the mask and be who you are. And because that's really the only way we can live well, that we can live happily. You can't breathe behind the mask. You sort of suffocate to stay that way. And that's really what Avery realizes. She realizes that she's got to be who she really is. And that may not be who her family really expects her to be, and it may not be who society expects her to be, but it's who she is.
How different is this from other books that you've written? Was this more difficult to write because of the content?
As a parent, it's hard. You know, as a parent, you can't help but look into these situations and imagine your own children involved in this at 3, 4, 5, 10, 12 years old. And you know well, because my kids are raised now, so I've been through all those stages with them. And, you know, I know what a 10-year-old knows and thinks, and what a 6-year-old knows and thinks, and how vulnerable a 3-year-old is. And so you can't help but imagine your own children in those situations and think, how would they survive? How would they be affected by this? So I lived it in a very personal way as I was writing the story. And as a parent, it is hard. And as the book went on then to my literary agent and to my editor, they said the same thing. My agent still has young kids, and she says, oh, as a mother of young kids, it's fascinating and appalling at the same time, because you do live it in a really personal way. And so for this book, that was probably the hardest part for me, was really looking at, honestly, what are the stories of these kids like? How are they thinking about it at the age they're at? But I've worked with a lot of youth over the years, so I've seen a lot of these situations. I've been around a lot of kids who are coming through off and on custody situations or difficult family situations. So, you know, I sort of equated it with them. And the great thing about fiction is all those situations you worked in life and you couldn't fix, you couldn't bring a kid out of the mentality of their birth family, or you couldn't wrestle the child loose from the people who had control over this child. Everything, you can fix all that in fiction. That's the great thing about fiction. You can provide that ending that you wish you could provide for every kid in real life. You can just take it and make it happen. And books sometimes get faulted for happy endings, and I just don't agree. If I invest my time in a story, I want to see light and hope on the other end. I want to see my characters come out better and stronger and able to have an effect on the world, and wanting to have an effect on other people who are in this situation. And that's why I take part in a story. So for me, the ultimate satisfaction of the story was to be able to, in some way, have justice done for these kids in the story.
Well, I appreciate you sharing the time with us today, and I wish you all the success with this one and your next one, too.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lisa. We've reached the end of our time for today's book talk. I've been speaking with Lisa Wingate about her book, Before We Were Yours. Using two fictional families, Lisa tells the true story of the Tennessee Children's Home Society, an adoption organization that kidnapped and sold poor children to families all over the country. The book is published by Ballantine. I'm Linda Lloyd, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.